Good to be here this morning. And we're all here because of Eliezer, who we owe a tremendous debt of hakaras hatov to, of gratitude, because he brought our family together. He made the Jewish people develop into what it is, because he was sent on a mission by Avraham Avinu that we read about in this week's Parsha and Parsha's Chayisara. He was given the task of finding a shidduch for great, 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 great grandpa Yitzchak. And he did so with tremendous success. So we have a wonderful hakaras hatov to him. We're very grateful to him for this, even though he doesn't seem to get all the credit he deserves. In the Parsha, he's not actually even named, which is an interesting topic, maybe for a different time. The fact that the Parsha does not use his name in telling us who it was who was doing this mission. But what's also surprising is that we find that Chazal seemed to be critical of Eliezer. And that's something I'd like to discuss a little bit this morning for a few minutes, some of the lessons that can be learned from looking at this mission of Eliezer, and in particular Chazal's relationship to it, and what that may tell us about life in general, and some of what is going on right now, and some of the issues that we confront daily. So we'll try to look for a few minutes at this whole episode of Eliezer's mission, and maybe we'll take a few detours along the way for some other interesting points that might be able to be derived from this story. So what's surprising to us is that despite the fact that it's clear that Eliezer's mission was a tremendous success and that he pulled it off very well, we do find, at least in two places in Shas, what seem to be critical statements about it. And on the surface, what was the mission? Here, Eliezer is sent to find a shidduch for the Jewish people, shidduch for Yitzchak to continue the growth of the Jewish people, what would become the Jewish people. And he's looking for a person of chesed, which is striking on many levels. It's a continuation of the theme of Parshas Vayera, where we read in such great detail about Avraham's chesed and about all of the activities that he does for others. It's what starts off that Parsha. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu declares about Avram that he is the one who will carry on this path of chesed and teach it to his family and to his descendants. And that is why he is picked to found the Jewish nation. So certainly that makes sense. The idea that we're looking for people of chesed, that certainly fits the theme. That's certainly a very appropriate plan. And that would make sense to be the number one aspect to search out. It's also interesting, some of the Rishonim discuss that here Avram had asked for a shidduch from his family and that Eliezer should go over there to find an appropriate shidduch, even though his family, as we know, were idolaters. So it's not exactly the most appropriate place you would think to look for the perfect shidduch for the family of Avraham Avinu. And some of the Rishonim comment, the Ran and a few others point out that this shows the importance of midos even more than some other components that we might think are absolutely crucial. And they are crucial. There's no question that the proper philosophy is certainly crucial for the Avodas Hashem. But that, as Rishonim explained, can be taught, while the midos are harder to find, and the midos are more going to be a function of the environment. So therefore, he is focusing appropriately on this midah of chesed and making that his number one priority. And he sets up a test in order to find who's going to be the biggest balos midos. Who's it going to be? Who's going to show kindness to him, to the animals? Makes a lot of sense. Worked out great. So far, everything seems perfect. However, we find these two statements in Shas, at least, where there is what seems to be a criticism. So on the one hand, there is the Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Tainis, where the Gemara suggests that what Eliezer did was not appropriate, and that he's in the category of people should be kesh shaloka hogun, who asked in an appropriate manner, in an inappropriate manner, that there are a number of individuals in Tanakh who did that, who made requests that were not appropriate. And for some it worked out, and for some it didn't work out. And Eliezer worked out despite the fact that he asked inappropriately. Because who knows? Okay, so maybe he controlled for this one factor, but who knows otherwise how appropriate of a shidduch would have been, or how desirable of a shidduch would have been. And therefore, he took a risk. He wasn't necessarily acting with complete responsibility. That's what that Gemara seems to suggest. And in addition to that, there is a Gemara in Maseches Chulin, which goes further and seems to suggest that Eliezer was in violation of an Isser. What was the Isser? What was the prohibition? We have a prohibition in the Torah, in Parshat Shoftim. The Torah tells us that we're not allowed to act superstitiously. It's the prohibition of Nechush, that we shouldn't make decisions based on random indications. That if we say that, okay, if a black hat passes me today, I'll sell all my stocks, and if it rains, I'll buy this stock, and if a green car passes next, I'll do this. So that is not only unwise, but it is a prohibition of nechush, which could be roughly translated as superstition for our purposes. In modern Hebrew, it means to guess. But here in this halakhic context, it seems to mean to be superstitious, to base your decisions on irrational factors. And in discussing that prohibition, the Gemara Maseches Chulin says that kol nechush she'eno keliezer ever Avram eino nechush. Right? There's other things they also were just focusing on this one line, that in order for nechush to really be nechush, if you really want to do glot nechush, you really want to make sure that you're really in violation of prohibition, the standard that it has to reach is that of Eliezer ever Avram. So this is very difficult on a number of levels. Right? So here, poor Eliezer in our parsha, he doesn't get named. You just have to figure out who we're talking about. But when we're talking about the negative, we're talking about the Avera of Nechush. Here he gets named. Here he is identified as the standard for Nechush. And that's difficult on a number of levels. First and foremost, or maybe not foremost, but first, so we would assume that Eliezer would do the right thing, and we would not suspect him of being in violation of the prohibition of Nechush. Now, why not? So is he subject to the prohibition of Nechush? Was Eliezer Jewish? Was Avram even Jewish? So Pash, this is, it's a whole discussion whether Avram was yet Jewish, if Judaism existed or not, until later. But we do have the tradition that the Avos kept the entire Torah. Should that apply to Eliezer also? Okay, so Eliezer was not Jewish even by that standard. It's a discussion whether Nechush and all the prohibitions that are associated with magic, does that apply to B'nai Noach as well? So there is somewhat of a discussion about that, but whether or not that's the case, it's safe to assume that Eliezer acting on a mission from Avram would stay in keeping with halachic values. It's just interesting, parenthetically, to point out that there is extensive literature working off the assumption that we can derive halachic principles from Eliezer's behavior. There is a discussion, much of the contemporary literature, that often looks at some of the stories in Chumash from a halachic perspective. So there is a discussion whether Eliezer was there just as a shadchan or as a shliach likedushin. Was it his job to find the proper shidduch for Yitzchak, or was it more than that? Was he given the mission to effect kedushin on Yitzchak's behalf? And in many of the svarim, they work off the premise that Eliezer was indeed a shliach l'kiddushin, that he was not only identifying the right choice, but he was carrying out the kiddushin, and that we can look to his behavior to learn out details of how shlichus l'kiddushin works. There are some who even assume, therefore, not only that he was acting halachically, but that he was keeping Ashkenazi minhagim. So, for example, there is a comment of the Kedushas Levi, Rebbe Yitzchak of Berdichev, who observed the fact that Psukim tell us that Eliezer declines to eat until he does what he's there for. They offer him food, and he says, I'm not going to eat until I accomplish what I need to do, until I say what I have to say. So why did he not want to eat? So the Kedushas Levi suggests that it's because there is a minig that a chassan on the day he gets married fasts. And this minig happens to be really Ashkenazi minig. Rav Vaji Yosef pointed out in the tshuva that you don't find this minig among the Sfardim, but it's a minig among the Ashkenazim, that among many Ashkenazim, that Chassan and the Kala on the day of their marriage don't eat. So therefore, because he was carrying out Kedushin on behalf of Yitzchak, so Eliezer was fasting. So apparently not only was he makbid on halachas according to this, but even the Ashkenazi minhagim he was also makbid on. It's interesting, just parenthetically also, that there are some who object to this interpretation of the Kedushas Levi, and they say, you see, it's not the case, because the Psukim tell us that he wasn't fasting, because we see that he drank water. So if he drank water, apparently he wasn't fasting. So why does the Kedushas Levi make this interpretation that he was fasting as a shliach l'kedushin? So perhaps we actually could defend Eliezer. He needs some defense today, but we could also defend the Kedushas Levi. So the Kedushas Levi, who was so famous for being Malamed Tzchus on the Jews, he always had a way to defend Klal Yisrael, so we have to defend him also. I think you could defend his interpretation here, that it's not necessarily a contradiction to say that he was fasting and he drank water, because there is a discussion in the poskim, the Primogodim and others, about this minig for the chassan to fast. Does it apply also to a shliach? If one is not getting married personally, but he is appointing a shliach to do it on his behalf, does the shliach have to fast? And the Achronim assume that it depends. What is the reason for the fast? Is the reason because it's a personal Yom Kippur, that there's a kapara happening that day, or is the reason because you want to make sure you don't get drunk? You want to make sure that you are of sound mind and body when you effect the kedushin. And they assume that that would affect the question of what about a shliach l'kedushin? That if the purpose of the fast is because it's a personal Yom Kippur, because there's a kapara, so then the shliach shouldn't fast because it's the chassan who gets the kapara. So the chassan who's at home, let him fast. And the shliach who's off on the mission, he doesn't have to fast. But if the idea is you want to make sure everything is carried out properly with sound mind and body and no one should get drunk, so then the chassan necessarily wouldn't have to fast because he's not doing anything. But the shliach who's carrying out the mission, so he should fast. So the whole idea that a shliach l'kedushin should fast is premised on the idea that he's trying to avoid getting drunk. So if that's the purpose, if that's the reason for the fast, so the Aruch HaShulchan writes, and others write as well, that if the goal is to not get drunk, it doesn't have to be an absolute fast. It just has to be staying away from any major eating, and to drink water is okay. To drink water is acceptable. So the Kedushas Levi's interpretation could be defended, that it's possible that he did have water, but he was still fasting overall. He was abstaining from any kind of heavy eating in keeping with this interpretation that a Shliach L'Kedushin only has to fast in that sense of the word. Okay, so there's a lot of literature about that, about those related issues, working off the assumption that Eliezer was keeping halacha even down to very small degrees. So now here for the Gemara to accuse him of nechush is somewhat surprising. How could we say that he would have been neglectful towards this prohibition of not acting in a superstitious way? But probably more fundamentally, one could ask, why would I even think that this is nechush? Why would this be considered something that's a violation of that principle? The whole idea of nechush is that you are making decisions based on irrational factors, that you are doing things that don't make any sense. So you're going to sell your stocks because a green car passed. There's no correlation between a green car passing you and selling your stocks. There's nothing to do with each other. So to make a decision based on that, that would be a violation of nechush. But what Eliezer was doing was completely logical. It made sense. It was a rational test. He was looking for a person of chesed. So he orchestrated this test to try to figure out who's a person of chesed. Who is it who's going to supply water to him and to his camels? So what's wrong with that? That was a perfectly logical test. And that was indeed successful, it would seem, because it made sense. So why should Eliezer be held up as the symbol of this transgression of Nechush? So there is a discussion in the Rishonim, there's a debate in the Rishonim as to how exactly to read this Gemara. And indeed, there are some Rishonim who argue that it doesn't really mean to be critical of Eliezer, but it's using him as a symbol for other purposes. So this was a debate, for example, between the Rambam and the Ravid, that the Rambam, when he records the prohibition of Nechush, so he uses this language of the Gemara that Eliezer, Eved Avram, was a symbol of this transgression, and the Ravid gets very upset at him, and the Ravid says, no, it doesn't mean that. He's misreading what the Gemara is saying. And a number of the other Rishonim, Tosfos and the Ran and others, they also get involved in defending Eliezer, saying the Gemara doesn't mean to suggest that Eliezer was in violation of Nechush, but the Gemara is using him as a symbol for an educational point, but it doesn't mean that he himself was actually committing this Avera. So what is the point then? The Rishonim have different ways of formulating it. But the way the Ran and a few others say is that the Gemara is trying to illustrate that in order to violate Nechush technically, in order to really commit the prohibition in the technical sense, one has to not only use an irrational sign, but one has to depend on it completely. That if he says, I am going to sell my stocks because of this green car that passed me, and that's the whole reason, nothing to do with the market, nothing to do with my analysis, it wasn't 50-50 before, but it's because of this one factor that's going to make or break the decision, so that is Nechush. But if you have a number of other factors that you are combining, and it's interesting to note also that a green car passed me, and that's always unlucky when I see it, and that's a part of the discussion, but it's not the main reason why you're doing it, you're not making the decision completely dependent on that, so that's not Nechush. So how do you know the standard for Nechush? Look at Eliezer, Eved Avram, look how dependent he was on his sign, and that shows us what Nechush is. So that's a very strong statement. It's interesting on a number of levels. What it seems to be indicating is that the Gemara is trying to teach us really that there are two requirements in order for one to violate Nechush, that it has to be irrational, and it also has to be the complete reason why you're doing something. You are dependent on this 100%. So Eliezer is only reflective of one of those two things. His action was not irrational. It was rational. It made sense. But the detail that the Gemara is focusing on was his complete dependence on this. So all we're taking away from him is this, even though he himself didn't have both conditions. He was not in violation because he was doing something that made sense. But the factor that we're interested in is that he was making his decision completely on this factor. So that could be, and that would exonerate Eliezer. That would teach us that he's not necessarily to be criticized for this avera or for violating this principle, but it's still very difficult to understand, because if that's indeed the case, so then why does Eliezer have to be the poster boy for this avera? Why does he have to be held up as the symbol of this transgression here for his great success in this mission? The Torah doesn't tell us his name, but the Gemara uses him as a symbol of bad behavior, that even if he wasn't actually the guy who did it, but nonetheless, he's the one who teaches it. It's as if we're trying to say, don't be Mechalel Shabbos by doing what that guy did. And we hold this person up as a symbol of Chilul Shabbos. And when you point out that he's a tzaddik and he never violates Shabbos, saying, no, that he does these things on Tuesday, but what he does on Tuesday, you shouldn't do on Shabbos. So he's the symbol, he's the cautionary tale, don't be Mechalel Shabbos, even though he never did any such avera. But we're using his activities during the week as a symbol of what you shouldn't do on Shabbos. And we're going to put posters up around saying, don't be like this guy, don't be Mechal Shabbos. So that seems still pretty damaging. That still seems to be pretty unflattering for whoever we're putting up on that poster. So to say that Eliezer represents Nechush when he didn't really violate Nechush, it's just one detail that we're borrowing from him, that also seems to be very difficult. So how could we explain that? Why did Chazal come with such an attitude towards Eliezer if what he did makes sense? And we are the beneficiaries. It was a tremendous chesed for us that he was able to make such a wonderful shidduch for our great-great-great-grandparents. So why are we so critical towards him? So I think perhaps what the message is that, yes, it's true that what Eliezer did was not pure nechush, because it was a rational system to come up with a appropriate result based on relevant indications. So from that perspective, indeed, it was not nechush. But the way he carried it out did have a little bit too much in common with nechush. And there is a cautionary tale. Now, this is working off an assumption of how exactly it happened, and the Rishonim do, and the commentaries in general, do debate this a little bit. But working off this premise, which is somewhat debatable, but seems to be the message here, that assuming that he was checking for this one midah of chesed, and he was making it entirely dependent on this particular action, that is dangerous. And that is something that we do all the time, that we assume that there is a 100% correlation between a certain activity and a midah, that people who are kind act this way, people who aren't kind act a different way, and people who are nice do this, people who are mean do that, people who are whatever, people who are smart act this way, people who are foolish act another way. And we create a complete correlation between the two. And we assume that we can always read into what people are, from what they do, from one activity that happens to be what we're witnessing. We're able to interpret what they're all about. And this is very dangerous, because there may be a correlation. It may be that there is a certain matchup between certain activities and certain midos, but it's very often far from perfect. So when we look at a certain action, we say, okay, now I know what that person is about. That's very dangerous in both directions. So for example, here, Eliezer is assuming, okay, who is a kind person? A kind person is the one who's going to provide water for me and my camels. So yes, it's probably true that there's a high correlation between people who are kind and people who would do that. But it could be in either direction that it might be off. It could be that the kindest person in the world may be there that day and for whatever reason may not take up this particular task. Or it could be that somebody else may take up this task and doesn't have such motivations, may have some ulterior considerations that you don't know about. So to assume that there is a perfect correlation between how I perceive a kind person would act and how a non-kind person would act on the other extreme, that can be very dangerous. And this is something that psychologists refer to as the fundamental attribution error, that somebody sees activity in another person and he assumes, okay, now I can tell you what that person is all about. Now I understand who they are because I can interpret based on that action. And it's something, part of the flaw in this thinking is that we usually only apply it to others and not to ourselves. So some give the example, if you see somebody push somebody in line, somebody pushes to get to the front of the line, so you see the person who does that, you think that person is a jerk. Aye, but you just did it this morning. You also pushed in front of somebody else in line. Yeah, you're in a rush and you're having a bad day and you're distracted. So you're normally a nice guy. Today, for whatever reason, you acted in a way that doesn't look so nice, but it doesn't really define you. For the other guy, it totally defines him. This is what that person is about. For me, it's not what I'm about. It just happens to be an external action based on circumstances, doesn't define my character. So the flaw goes in two ways, that it's not accurate when it's applied to other people to assume that we can totally read their character based on whatever action we are observing. And we also don't usually apply it back to ourselves. When we're talking about how we interpret our own actions, we recognize that there are all kinds of complicating factors. We don't think that whatever we did today whatever we did this morning totally defines us, but by other people, we think that that's true. So this error is fundamental, as the phrase goes. And even if sometimes you're right, even if sometimes there is a correlation, so therefore the odds are very often there will be a lineup, but also very often there will be major mistakes based on that assumption. And it has a very damaging effect on our relationships, because when we say, oh, if he was really a nice guy, he would do this. If she really loved me, she would do that, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not really a perfect correlation. So we end up reading things into behavior that is unjustified and that is very unfair. And perhaps that is one of the major reasons that we have a prohibition of Lashon Hara. It's always a question why it is that the Torah should prohibit us talking about people if what we're saying is true, if what we're saying is factual. So why should it be a prohibition? Okay, I'm not allowed to slander people, but to say something that's true, why should that be prohibited? It's a topic that we've discussed in the past. Why should there be an Isser Lashon Hara if what you're saying is factual? So assuming that we actually know what's factual and what isn't, which is itself a problem. Very often we think things are factual and we're very incorrect and we're surprisingly incorrect. But let's stipulate for a second that whatever episode I'm describing, I'm actually factually correct. It actually happened what I'm saying. Still, there comes a big risk along with that, because we have a human tendency, as the fundamental attribution error indicates, we have a human tendency to overread the facts. So we see a certain thing happen and we bring interpretations to that that are not justified and that are not helpful, and that create a picture that is much worse than it needs to be. So perhaps that's one of the concerns that we have with Lashon Hara, that even if one thinks he's speaking the truth, nonetheless, the listener who hears the statement is not going to get a correct picture and is often going to take whatever story he hears and run with it in a direction that is very unhelpful. So that is perhaps why we have this prohibition of Lashon Hara, that we have to be very careful in what we say, because even if the facts are there, the interpretation can be very incorrect. And this comes up in every area of life. And just to say only a word or two, because already it's a contentious idea, but here we are at the end of a very contentious election season. And just to say a word about how this applies. So we saw, especially perhaps even more than ever, the great intensity of emotion and of feelings towards people throughout the course of this emotion, and of course of this election, which is an emotional election, and the idea of people judging and assessing each other very harshly because of their political preferences. And we often hear perhaps conflicting feelings. On the one hand, so when rabbis get involved in politics and they say who to vote for, who not to vote for, so people understandably get upset and they say that Rabbanim shouldn't be involved in politics to that degree. And on the other hand, the counter argument is, how could you not be involved? We're dealing with issues that are so important and issues that impact on Jewish values. Almost everything impacts on Jewish values. And therefore, if the rabbi's job is to talk about Jewish values, so how can the rabbi not be involved in politics? It's a dereliction of duty. How could you say that he shouldn't say what is important to know about whatever the issues are and the political decisions that need to be made? And the truth is, they're both true. They're both correct. That, yes, it is absolutely crucial to appreciate the perspective of the Torah and of the halacha on issues of values. But the question of politics, when it's used perhaps with a lowercase p, perhaps however you want to interpret it, is the idea that the assumption that a value necessarily only translates into one specific policy and only necessarily associates with one individual who may be connected to those policies, that's where there's a jump. And the jump may be very a strong correlation, maybe based on a weak correlation, and may be very subjective. But that's where the objection comes from, the assumption that the values interpretation, where the halacha has a tremendous amount to say and where it's our basic obligation to turn to the Torah for all of our wisdom. Yes, that's absolutely the case. But to assume that we're 100% sure that that value correlates only with a certain policy and only with a certain individual, that's where there's a lot of room for difference. And that's perhaps where we stumble into something that may resemble nechush. So perhaps what the Gemara is telling us, to be so sure that the tests that we set up, we correlate, I'm not going to respond to all the comments right now, we correlate with certain attitudes, that's where there is something that borders on nechush. And that's what Chazal is telling us, that as rational and as understandable as Eliezer's plan was, the assumption that that is completely separate from nechush is not a perfect assumption, because to have a absolute reliance on that test would indeed be nechush. And this is true in many areas of life. It's true very much in shiduchim, that when one is looking to choose a marriage partner, as is the larger theme of Eliezer's mission, so there as well. So we set up assumptions, and we say, okay, that if she acts like this, I'll know she's a balas midas, I'll know she's a balas chesed, I'll know she's tsanua. If he acts this way, then I know that he's a ben Torah, I know that he's going to be a caring husband. I know because I have set up this kind of analysis. And who knows, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. And there's an interesting halachic discussion to be had, which maybe we'll have at a different stage, whether it's permissible to set up tests in order to try to ascertain people's midos. Somebody wants to know if somebody else is a balkas or not. Does somebody have a temper? So they'll act in a provocative way and see how the other individual responds. So it's an interesting question whether that's permissible to do in the first place, whether that's a prohibition of lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, of possibly creating a stumbling block for someone else in the area of midos. It's not just in the area of active sins, but in the area of character traits. There's an interesting literature about whether that's permissible or not. In the case of Eliezer, it seems like it was looking for a positive attribute, so either he saw it or didn't see it. But if you're looking for a negative attribute, then you possibly provoke that negative attribute. So there's quite a literature and it to be considered about whether that's permissible or not. But setting aside the question of lifnei iver, the question of whether you're possibly responsible for whatever you are evoking, but the question of whether the test is even appropriate or not, that itself, whether the test is even going to show you anything or not, whether you're even calibrating the grading properly, is a very open question. There's an interesting literature, if you read Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. So the question of how to interpret whether if the man holds the door open for the woman, if she opens the door for him, if she opens the car lock, how do you interpret that? And there are different shitas about what that means and what that doesn't mean. So how much we darshan these simanim, how much we try to give meaning to things which may have different kinds of interpretations, is a very sensitive area, and something that we have to think about very carefully. And it's important to appreciate, and if we had more time, we'd say more about this, but when we're told that we have to be honest in shiduchim, and we have to tell people what they need to know as far as being forewarned and as far as entering with eyes open into a relationship. So here people often do the opposite of what they're supposed to do, that there are big issues that need to be warned, that need to be alerted. And very often we don't want to do that because we're afraid to shter shidduch, so we don't want to warn people about what's important. And unfortunately, there are very tragic consequences sometimes because people haven't been told about things that would make a big difference to their relationship and their happiness and their safety. And there is a very strong obligation to come forward with what you know. But on the other hand, we often say things that we don't know. So we say things that are based on interpretations of how we would associate various actions or how things seem to us. This was discussed in the Beis Medrash once, that nowadays there is a new standard for shiduchim, that in addition to everything else, is a standard of ri'as ha'chaverim, that the friends have to see it, the friends have to be able to prophesize that it's all going to be a perfect personality match, and it's often not based on anything real, and many otherwise very promising shiduchim are destroyed or are never considered because somebody assumes that they can assess based on whatever standard they have shown up, whatever standard they have developed, and it's not really based on actual facts. So we often do the exact opposite of what we should do. We know that there really is danger, there really is a potential problem, so we don't come forward when we should, and that's a very damaging situation. And on the other hand, we often volunteer our opinion when we really don't know, when we think that we can build a whole structure based on whatever we're interpreting, and it's not fair, we do a lot of damage that way. So if all of this is the case, so why is it that Eliezer was granted such success? If he didn't take a 100% perfect plan, and if the Gemara thinks that he asked inappropriately and uses him as the poster boy for Nechush, maybe because he's not totally innocent, he does deserve some criticism, and there is some lasting lesson from this error. So why was he zocha that it worked out so well? So why was it that indeed the plan was successful? So perhaps we can interpret that. Rav Soloveitchik had a comment that was recorded in the book Abraham's Journey that was printed from Meyotzer Harav a number of years ago, where Rav Soloveitchik commented about this whole story that because chesed was so crucial to the building of the Jewish people and it was so absolute as a factor, so Eliezer was not looking for somebody who just had chesed within them, but was looking for somebody who was the complete paragon, totally defined by chesed in an absolute sense. And here in this case, perhaps it made sense that he could be especially demanding in what he was looking for. And Rav Soloveitchik explains in some detail that very often people are kind and helpful because they're polite. And Eliezer was specifically looking for somebody who wasn't just polite, but for somebody who was driven by a devotion to chesed in the absolute sense. So therefore, he makes some pretty extreme requests, and he asks for her to pour the water directly into his mouth, which seems kind of rude, seems obnoxious. And a host who's being polite says, okay, I'll help for normal requests. But if somebody really seems to be out there in what they're asking, if a person is just polite and just trying to be civil, they're not necessarily going to be responsive to that. But here you have somebody who's going so far above and beyond. Rivinus and Eibschitz pointed out to emphasize why it wasn't superstitious, because it wasn't just a rational siman, this is a siman muvok, that he was looking for somebody who both was going to act with extraordinary kindness and also do things that would seem physically impossible for the labor that she was trying to carry out there. He's clearly also being endorsed by God in how she was acting. So it was a siman muvok. He was looking really for something which was extraordinarily correlating, and therefore it's understandable in this case that he was looking for something really above and beyond, and he found it. You know, just parenthetically, it's interesting. So the literature that talks about deriving various halachos from Eliezer's behavior, so there's a literature also that discusses la halacha, what you can learn from Rivka's behavior. So, for example, we have a halacha, the Gemara says in a few places, that you're obligated to feed your animals before you feed yourself. So how come here we find that Rivka gives the water to Eliezer before the camels? Isn't that against the halacha? Aren't you supposed to feed the animals before you feed the people? So the Sefer Chassidim and others discuss this. Some suggest that it's because there is a difference between drinking and eating. So drinking, you can have the human being drink first and give water to the animals afterwards. It's only with eating that we have the priority given to the animals. Rav Tzipi Pesach Frank has a tshuva about that. Is that because water is more urgent? It looks like he was going to collapse, and therefore you have to make sure that the human being survives first. But then the meal, which can wait a little bit longer, you give to the animals first, or the meal is more distracting. You'll forget about the animals, but a little bit of water you won't forget. That's a discussion. The Chassam Sofer suggests it only applies when you're feeding yourself. So when you're eating, you have to eat, you have to give to the animals before you eat. But when you're feeding somebody else, you're feeding a guest, then you can feed the guest before you feed the animals. So there's a lot of halachic literature also about Rivka's behavior here, just like there is from Eliezer's behavior. But the point that Rav Soloveitchik emphasized is that we're looking here for a person whose chesed is so deep and so a priori, is so l'chachila, it's not just based on responding to a circumstance, but is willing to go above and beyond and cover every possible base. It was only somebody like that who would be appropriate for Yitzchak. And if that's the case, so then perhaps that can explain why Eliezer was successful despite this imperfection, and leaves us with an important message, which I think in terms of this aspect of judging, that we have to have a double standard. I'm going to advocate the double standard. We're usually against double standards, but I think in this case, in cases like this, double standards are important. That when you're deciding how to behave yourself, you have to behave in a very explicit, clear way so that nobody can misinterpret the way you speak, nobody can misinterpret the way you act, and everyone understands that they're being treated in a kind and respectful and sensitive factor, a sensitive attitude. And one has to hold themselves to the highest possible standard of how they can be interpreted, how they are being perceived, and how they are communicating. But when judging someone else, so then we have to recognize that there are all kinds of elements that we don't necessarily see, and we don't necessarily have the whole picture, and we should be much kinder in our assessment of how other people are operating and how we're interpreting. In other words, we should have the exact opposite of the fundamental attribution error. The fundamental attribution error means that we judge ourselves by a much more forgiving standard than we do everyone else. And really, we should do the opposite. We should hold ourselves to a very high standard in terms of how we communicate and allow ourselves to be perceived. And when judging others, we should be very understanding that there are a complexity of elements that we don't necessarily know about. And this is perhaps one of the messages of last week's parasha, the parasha that we read yesterday, so that we are told that Avraham Avinu is selected because he is going to transmit the message to his descendants of Staku Mishpat. And the Chafetz Chaim in a Sefer Avos Chesed raises the question, what does it mean, Staku Mishpat? They seem to be contradictory ideas. That Mishpat suggests kind of Amidas Tadin, that you're going to be very exacting and everything has to fit perfectly. And Staku suggests a more generous and forgiving attitude. So which is it? Is it Staku or is it Mishpat? And he writes that really it's both. It depends who we're talking about. And here he uses the focus of property. And he says that when you're dealing with somebody else's property, so you'll be very careful not to take anything that doesn't belong to you and to completely respect the integrity of the property of another and to be very, very careful. I'll pee the din of Mishpat. But when it's about your own property and how can you let others benefit from it and how can you be helpful towards other individuals, so then the attitude should be one of Staka, should be one of a much more open standard. So it's Mishpat as far as you relate to protecting the rights of others, and it's Staka as far as you relate to how you give to others. And perhaps that's also true when it comes to judgment, that we should have also these two different standards, that as far as how people judge us, we have to act with Mishpat and make sure that we're providing all of the elements for the highest possible standard of interpretation. But as far as how we judge other people, we also have to have an attitude of Staka, an attitude of recognizing that there needs to be much more latitude given and much more acknowledgement of some of the complicating factors. So I know Alpi Mishpat, our time is up. So I'll just very quickly recap the main highlights. So we spoke about the question of Eliezer. We're very grateful to him for the great shidduch that he brought about and how that brought us to where we are today. But Chazal seemed to be critical, say that he asked inappropriately with his test for chesed and that it was a symbol of nechesh somehow. The Rishonim tried to figure out that it seems like this was very rational. How was this called nechesh? Some of the Rishonim suggest that it was rational. It wasn't superstitious, but still his complete reliance is symbolic of nechesh. And even if that lets him off the hook, then it's harder to understand why is he held up as the poster boy of this Aveira. And we suggested that maybe there is an element of nechesh here, that even though this test made sense, but to rely on it 100%, that is very dangerous, and it's something that we do all the time, like the fundamental attribution error, to assume that our interpretations of activities, as far as what they say about character, is 100% perfect, and that creates a lot of tension, a lot of machlokas, and perhaps that's why we have a prohibition of Lashon Hara. One of the reasons we have a prohibition of Lashon Hara, even if we're sure what we're saying is true about what happened, the interpretation is very, very risky. And then we discussed how that applies not only in the context of Lashon Hara, in the context of dating and of tests and the whole discussion of when tests are appropriate, mutter, if they are mutter, if they're not mutter, in addition to the question of naiver, but there's also the question of whether the test even makes sense in the first place. And we discussed a little bit how it affects our whole national climate and the whole election experience and the intense feelings that one has against those who feel differently. And on the one hand, yes, the topics are Dvarim Ha'om Debrum Sholom are incredibly important, but at the same time, the assumption that we're perfect in figuring out how the values are expressed through a policy or an individual is subject to much varied interpretations. And we talked about why should it be that Eliezer was successful if he made this mistake. We brought it into Soloveitchik's interpretation of how this was about not simply having a tendency towards chesed, but being completely committed to chesed way beyond the limits of being polite, and how that was reflected here. And then we advocated the double standard, as the Chafetz Chaim indicated by the interpretation of Staka Mishpat that we read yesterday, that towards others, we act towards respecting the rights of others, we act with Mishpat, but towards interpreting them and towards how we relate to our own contributions to their well-being, we act in staka. And indeed, that is what makes us who we are, the parasha tells us, and we should continue to have those midos define us, l'shem l'tiferes. I wish all hatzlacha and shalom to all of us, and we should know only good things in the days ahead.